You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is the nation's leader in cranberry production, but just how many berries are grown each season? We'll find out about new technology that's making it easier to count cranberries before they're harvested.
First, the JCPenney Corporation announced the closure of its distribution center in Wauwatosa this week, which will result in the loss of 670 jobs.
It's not the only recent retail news in the state. The parent company of Yonkers and Boston store, Bonton Stores, recently announced the closure of 42 locations due to restructuring. 9 brick-and-mortar retail stores in Wisconsin were included on that list.
Felicia Miller is an associate professor of marketing and chair of the marketing department at Marquette University. Felicia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
So the announcement from JCPenney Corporation about its distribution center, you know, it's coming at a time when we're getting some pretty not great retail news in the state. What challenges are being faced by these retail organizations and other giants like it?
I think overall in the market, Amazon has, you know, created a great deal of disruption that is making it challenging for traditional, you know, large chain department stores. There's too many outlets that don't really offer consumers different choices or things that are differentiating one store versus another. And then they, in many cases, have been just too slow to fully develop their online presence.
And both with the Bonton family of stores and JCPenney, you know, both of these closures fall into sort of this ongoing retail crisis with brick-and-mortar retailers in particular. Was there anything surprising to you about these announcements?
It's a little unusual to hear so much about the closure of a distribution center, like the JCPenney one that's going to close. Obviously, it's going to impact a lot of people's jobs, but it's also an indication that they're reducing their supply chain. They're being more strategic about where they have distribution centers, trying to maximize existing distribution centers, and creating a more efficient system that will ultimately allow them to serve customers better and possibly also offer lower prices.
So decisions like these, you know, the heads of these companies have said, hey, this is part of our restructuring. We are trying to be smarter about our business. We're trying to provide a better service for our customers. But what do closures like these mean for the communities that they've been in for a while?
Aside from the impact of people who are losing their jobs, it also gives those consumers in those communities fewer choices. If store closures continue, they may have only one or two options to really, you know, find the things that they want, or they may have to travel outside of their community. So it has a direct impact on the consumer's choices as well.
We're talking to Felicia Miller right now. She's an associate professor of marketing and the chair of the marketing department at Marquette University. We're talking about JCPenney Corporation saying that they are closing a distribution center in Wauwatosa. And this is coming sort of on the heels of the Bonton store saying that they're going to be closing stores throughout Wisconsin as well as the Midwest. So when it comes to the state of retail in Wisconsin, just how are we doing?
I think we have way too much, given the consumer demand in terms of retail options. I think we have not really assessed what the needs of consumers are, not only in terms of what stores do they want to shop in, but where are those stores located. We've seen a lot of migration across the country of people going away from the traditional suburban mall set up with big anchor stores to more neighborhood stores where you can park and just walk right in. So that's part of it too. Sort of the life cycle of retail has shifted. And in Wisconsin, I don't know that we've really taken advantage of that shift with a lot more, you know, local presence, local stores than we're seeing in other communities.
So if Wisconsin hasn't maybe followed suit the way maybe other communities or other states have with this move from malls to, I guess, more local stores, do you think that Wisconsin can catch up to other states?
I think we certainly can. And, you know, the Mayfair Collection in Wauwatosa is a great example where you've got mixed-use commercial real estate with everything from, you know, restaurants and bars to traditional retail outlets to, you know, smaller grocery stores or unique grocery stores. You've got a nice mix of things that would draw people to that area for different reasons. And that's really more of what we're seeing happening across the country, giving people more of a local, authentic experience versus, you know, more of a cookie-cutter, big box type of retail outlet.
So when I was younger, obviously going to the mall was a big draw. It would be something that we did on the weekend with my friends. You know, I'm a little bit older now. So I guess my question is, what is, in, from your perspective, what's driving the move from malls and the preference for malls back maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago to some of these local stores?
I think we've seen our economy shift, obviously with the most recent recession, but I think also consumers' tastes have changed with the, you know, strong growth in the younger cohorts of consumers, millennials and so forth. They're looking for something a little different than maybe a consumer was looking for 10 or 15 years ago. We hear the term the experience economy a lot. But it's true. People are seeking out unique experiences, opportunities to do things different that, you know, they don't walk into a restaurant and say, oh, I've been here 10 times, it's always the same. They're looking for unique opportunities to sort of expand their experience, and that applies to restaurants, it applies to retail, to lots of different elements of our society.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that Amazon has been kind of a big disruptor in the retail field. You know, they are starting to open up some brick-and-mortar style stores. I won't necessarily say that they are kind of stores in the traditional sense. They've also bought out places such as Whole Foods. I guess, writing on the wall, how big of a player do you think Amazon is going to be in this conversation moving forward?
Oh, it starts and ends with Amazon. I think every retail outlet has to think about how they satisfy their customer more. How do they give consumers the things that they want, when they want them, and how they want them? And being an online retailer primarily, Amazon has a lot of flexibility to be able to create new things. I mean, when they bought out Whole Foods, within a week of the acquisition, they had signage in Whole Foods that said Amazon on it. So they can move very quickly. It's a nimble organization relative to, you know, sort of legacy retail outlets like Macy's or Kohl's or Boston store. So that's part of it. I think it's time to sort of reinvent, you know, traditional retail for a lot of these companies.
So with that in mind, I guess, what advice would you have for, I guess, Wisconsin-based retailers to provide, I guess, a service that customers are now looking for that they weren't maybe looking for, you know, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is to leverage where you are. You know, we're in the state of Wisconsin. There's a lot of wonderful things about the state that could be, you know, a draw for any local retail center, integrating more about what's unique about us as opposed to just delivering something that you could get in Chicago or Minneapolis, thinking about differentiation. Right now, consumers could go to any one of a half dozen stores and buy, you know, a sweater, a shirt, a pair of jeans that's pretty much all the same. But what consumers are looking for now is things that are different, things that are unique, things that are authentic to what their experiences are and how they want to use those goods to, you know, create their own life experiences.
Well, Felicia, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Felicia Miller is an associate professor of marketing and the chair of the marketing department at Marquette University. She joined us to talk about the changing face of retail in Wisconsin and in the nation.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Erica Janik.
It's been called a town that time forgot. Norman Gilliland tells us about the unique charms of Cooksville.
If you're driving in a hurry on Highway 14 or I-39, it'll be no more than another sign that flashes by. But if you're an explorer of out-of-the-way places, you might slow down and discover Cooksville and Wisconsin, much as it was 175 years ago. The thing about Cooksville, which is about 25 miles south of Madison, is that it never grew up, and so it still looks like a lot of New England villages of the 1840s. Well, like much of Wisconsin, Cooksville was settled by New Englanders. And although he never set foot there, one very famous New Englander was an early owner of much of Cooksville. Daniel Webster was a senator, a congressman, secretary of state under three presidents, and a candidate for the presidency. In 1837, the U.S. government began selling land in Rock County, and Webster bought acreage along Badfish Creek, speculating that the area would draw settlers from New England. His name is the first one on every deed in the village. In the tradition of New England towns, the place was planned around a public square. One of Webster's Massachusetts friends, Dr. John Porter, bought a lot of the land from the senator at $1.25 an acre. And then came two brothers from Ohio, John and Daniel Cook, who also bought land from the government and platted Cooksville. Soon afterward, Porter founded nearby Wacoma. And when the post office took residence in Cooksville, the latter became the collective name of the two settlements. Houses sprang up around the town square, most of them red brick, straight, simple, and rock solid. The 1840s and 50s were boom times for Cooksville, which soon had a brickyard, a sash and door factory, a congregational church, a Lutheran church, a blacksmith shop, a school, and a general store. It was a time when growing was the thing for a town to do, and Cooksville flourished. Its population blossomed to 175. Like many towns in the late 19th century, Cooksville hovered on the threshold of greatness, lacking just one thing to make it grow into a bustling city. It didn't get it. The railroad bypassed Cooksville, and after a while, its 175 residents dwindled down to about 65. But being passed by was not the end of the world for Cooksville. While it may not have burgeoned into a metropolis, the town wound up with something rarer than unending growth: continuity. Over the years, Cooksville retained not only a tranquil life among farm fields and oak-studded grasslands, but also its original town square, surrounded by those mid-19th century houses, more than 30 of them, looking much as they did in the 1840s and 50s. It may well be the only town in Wisconsin with its original 19th century buildings, and nothing newer, surrounding the town square. The schoolhouse is still there and still has two entrances, one for boys and one for girls. The general store is still there, too, and is probably the oldest operating general store in Wisconsin. If you stick to the roads with speed limits of 65 and 70, you won't find any of it. But detour a few miles off the main drag and you'll find Cooksville, where the current residents, all 65 of them, see to it that the America of 175 years ago is still very much with us.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, Wisconsin grows more cranberries than any other state, but estimating just how many berries will come from a given harvest has been a time-consuming job for farmers.
But a new device designed by engineers at UW-Madison could make counting cranberries a lot easier. The technology relies on some of the same methods used for medical diagnosis and weather forecasting.
Benjamin Tilburg is an agricultural scientist for Ocean Spray Cranberries. He's based in Babcock, Wisconsin. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, I get why, if you're a farmer, you want to know how much of a crop you're going to get. Prior to this technology, how hard was it to estimate how many cranberries were showing up there on those plants?
Well, there's a little bit of history to this. I actually called Phil Brown today. He's a cranberry historian, local cranberry historian, and asked him the same question. Related to the earliest record that he has on growers estimating crops. And he told me a story about Clarence Searles, who would carry around a homemade 1-foot by 1-foot metal frame with a red handkerchief tied to the corner so he wouldn't lose it. He would throw it out in the vines and count all the fruit in the square, and then estimate based on a square foot in an acre and calculate the crop based on these measurements. Now, these growers and researchers still use this very archaic method today, but it's much more consistent in the beds that we have. And what I mean by that is the beds have fewer weeds, the varieties are more genetically uniform. But collecting that 1 foot by 1 foot square is still extremely laborious and not very accurate. Some growers just estimate by looking at the crop, but that can depend on how many layers of fruit are in the canopy.
Right, because you're trying to, in effect, look through the green part of the plant to see the berry part of the plant, right?
Right, right. And usually the canopy, cranberry canopy, is about 7 or 8 inches, and so the cranberries kind of lay anywhere from 2 to 3 inches below the canopy, kind of nestled in there nicely.
And so you thought there's got to be, we've got a lot of technology now, more sophisticated than a 1 foot bucket. You went looking for a better way to do this.
Yeah, after one season of collecting 4 squares on many, many beds and counting like 50,000 cranberries a season, I honestly, my back and my body said there just has to be a better way.
And so you went to some engineers at UW-Madison. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the cranberry industry is supported by specialists at UW-Madison, and we really have a great working relationship. So I looked across campus to the UW-Madison Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and found Susan Hagness and John Bosk on the Internet and sent them an email. They responded, and we met in Madison to discuss whether microwave technology could be a way to count cranberries. I remember one of our meetings carrying a 5-gallon bucket full of soil and vines a mile on campus because of parking so that John and Susan could see what kind of vegetative canopy the interrogation equipment had to measure through. So it was pretty interesting. But, you know, after this meeting, Alex Hoffer, who was a PhD student, began testing the leaves and the fruit to investigate the feasibility, you know, the contrast of the water content in the fruit versus the leaves to see if this would actually work.
So they're taking ideas. There's a lot of situations where you want to look through one thing to see the other thing in medicine, in weather. So they took some of those ideas and applied it to the cranberries, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, this is a similar method used, Doppler radar, measuring the water content in the atmosphere. Well, we're measuring the water content in the cranberries. And, you know, cranberries have, the fruit themselves has a 3-to-1 contrast in the physical basis of water content from the fruit to the berries. So that contrast allows the technology to work in a sense.
So the microwave rays bounce back differently from the leaves and the berries because of the different water content? Is that how it works?
Yes, exactly. Yep, there's a certain frequency that the UW researchers, Susan, John, and Alex, they use, and that frequency bounces back, and they get a reading based on that. And then from that reading, Alex is currently developing an algorithm to match the waves that he receives off of the apparatus that we use this year, the prototype technology, and then the actual fruit that I collected, the squares of fruit that I collected. So I'm still collecting squares, but maybe soon I won't have to.
So what you said, the apparatus, what does this thing look like? Is it like some kind of science fiction microwave cranberry gun or a big box or what? What is this?
Well, it's just an aluminum waveguide, and it's kind of an interesting story of told by Alex. This waveguide that is actually owned by Susan and John, they had acquired it early on in their careers, and it had been sitting in the basement. Well, they had this prototype they had pulled out and said, hey, I think this is something that'll work for this. So this waveguide is probably about 10 pounds, and they mounted a PVC mount on it, so that way it could hover over the vines. And it's really only about 9 inches by 6 inches by 8 inches, so just a small metal box.
And Ben, you know, you had the farmers over here having this problem trying to count the berries. You've got these engineers who probably never thought about cranberry counting in their lives. What was it like to bridge the gap between those two to maybe find a solution that's going to make life a lot easier for the cranberry farmers?
Honestly, it was just a beautiful happening of researchers coming together and working across fields and coming up with a solution that can really help cranberry farmers, hopefully in the next few years, spatially map their beds. So it's pretty fantastic that way.
And more testing coming up this summer, I imagine.
Yes, this past year, with funding from the Wisconsin Cranberry Board and Ocean Spray, we conducted a pilot study with a prototype waveguide on two central Wisconsin properties. The first generation prototype was mounted close to the ground, and measurements were taken from the PVC mounted waveguide. So this year in 2018, this next generation prototype will mount to a boom, which growers use to fertilize their beds. The boom's an 80-foot structure that hangs over the bed and delivers fertilizer and pesticides.
And we'll leave it there. Ben, thanks for joining us. That's Ben Tilburg, agricultural scientist for Ocean Spray. He's based in Babcock, Wisconsin, talking about a new way to count cranberries.
First, the word ageism was coined in 1969, but our guest says prejudice against older Americans is as common as ever.
Those over age 64 are often treated as a burden, as dependent citizens. Our next guest says negative behaviors and hate speech against the elderly is not just commonplace, it's tolerated.
Margaret Morgan Roth-Gillette joins us now. She's a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. Her latest book is Ending Ageism, or How Not to Shoot Old People. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So, looking at ageism, certainly in America, what do you think are some of the biggest offenders in terms of perpetuating ageism?
Well, I think it's good to start with the work, because the race to the bottom in contemporary capitalism has meant dropping people out of the workforce prematurely. I invented a term, middle ageism, so that we wouldn't miss this phenomenon, because economists and pundits, the press, use the term older worker. Now, but the people who are losing their jobs are often over 45, 50, 55.
And how is that different compared to previous decades when middle age was kind of seen as the pinnacle of your professional career?
Well, it has changed, I think, quite a lot. I think for some people, of course, it still is the pinnacle, or in fact, not quite the pinnacle. You can still keep on going in some fields. Finance is one of them. Until you're in your 80s and 90s, you own your own company, you're doing fine. What I think has happened is that we lost manufacturing jobs in the 1980s. So I'm talking about a historical phenomenon that has been going on for decades. We had outsourcing after that. And as these crippling political and economic facts were going on and not being stopped by government action, we were losing more and more people out of the workforce. Now, we see that, I think, in Hollywood, where there's been really a recent tradition, I think it's connected to the Me Too campaign, to just complain that as an actor, a woman actor, you are being a victim of sexist ageism at 37, which is what Maggie Gyllenhaal said, or you're at 45, or there just are no good parts for you, and so on. So these very visible women have been complaining about ageism in the workforce. And there's some complaints about IT, losses in the IT field for people who are actually over 35. God help that field. But I don't think that we see the correct numbers of the unemployed and the underemployed and the people who will never be employed because of the way capitalism is simply working through its way through the workforce.
So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point to, the outcomes are, of course, devastating for families. I think we see that in some of the midlife opioid crisis, for example, in some of the things that are going on in rural areas, the social exclusions, the ill health, but we also see suicide. We see suicides. There was some data about the suicides of men who were 50 to 54, and it had gone up 50% over a decade. Now, those are really very horrifying facts, and they can be linked to middle ageism.
So looking at middle ageism, and I want to broaden it out a little bit, because
sure.
Certainly in news stories, it's sort of finger-pointing between millennials versus, say, the boomers. Do you think that we're missing the point by pitting those two generations against each other?
Yes. I think it's a terrible thing to do. It started in the 1990s that the boomers, were being called the aging boomers even in the 80s. In other words, the boomers were sort of a target very early on in their generational life course. I am in a field, it's not gerontology, I call it age studies, and I was the first to call it age studies, because I felt that we needed a field in which we would be looking in an even-handed way at the way the generations were relating to one another and the way they were being pitted against one another and the way millennials were, or younger people in general, not just millennials, learning, being taught in a kind of rote way that old people were clinging to jobs, older workers wouldn't leave the workforce. Now, I mean, there are good reasons for not wanting to leave the workforce, particularly after the global catastrophe of 2008, which the United States seems to have started. I mean, if you are in age studies, you want to have full employment, and you want full employment to include people who want jobs at 75 and people who want jobs at 18 and people who are people of color who are not getting jobs, and the disabled who definitely often want to work. You don't want to force people to work when they are not able to, but you do want there to be interesting and well-paid employment for every marginalized category in the United States, and that is simply social justice, but social justice expressed through the workforce.
We're talking to Margaret Morgenroth-Goulette right now. She is a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. She's with us to talk about ageism. And just a second ago, you were talking about, younger generations sort of being taught, if not explicitly, that, you know, older people were, taking jobs. But it seems as though ageism can be slightly more pervasive than just talking about work. What other ways, I guess, do we as a society talk about, some of our elders?
Well, I could talk about walking while old. I think it's getting dangerous to be in a public area and be knocked over because you've become invisible.
Hmm.
But I think since it's because it's Valentine's Day, maybe I'll say something about images of sexuality.
Sure. I mean, we know that anti-aging products, I'm putting those in sort of air quotes right now, are extremely popular on the market. So, sure, what does, I guess, aging and sexuality look like?
I was teaching a class somewhere, and we were talking about verbal ageism, and somebody brought up a Valentine's Day card that said, quote, grow old and disgusting with me. So I think the image that old people are ugly and that, or older people, I mean, what is, who are old people again? Mm. I mean, is there a definition of that? Are you an older person who doesn't want to have sex or can't have sex when you're 50 years old? Or there are 90-year-olds who are enjoying their form, whatever they want, in terms of sexuality. So I think these stereotypes are very, very unpleasant. Anti-aging as a term, one of the women's fashion magazines decided they would never use it again. Hmm. Now, that's a good way to go. There is no way that you can produce an anti-aging product or cream that is actually going to do anything to keep you from getting a year older on your birthday.
So it's not the panacea being able to do that. We're talking to Margaret Morgenroth-Gillette right now, a resident scholar in the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. She's with us to talk about age discrimination and ageism.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see ageism, age discrimination affecting you in your life, maybe in your work? Do you feel like you were pushed out of the working world when you hit a certain age? Do you see that happening at your workplace? And do you feel like we in our culture of at any age talk in disparaging ways, unfair ways about older people? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll pick up this conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We continue our conversation about ageism with Margaret Morgenroth-Gillette. She's a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. Her latest book is Ending Ageism, or How Not to Shoot Old People.
She says ageism is common, even tolerated, and she's answering your questions, too, at 800-642-1234. Call in with your questions and experiences. Again, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Margaret, I want to go to a quick call right now. We have John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going okay. What do you want to say?
I just have a brief comment about the left and progressive movements in America in general and ageism. That we've done a decent job of keeping track of different categories of discrimination, but ageism is actually one of the things that's fallen off our radar, that's actually just been completely forgotten about. I remember growing up, I'm 55 years old, I remember growing up with the 60s culture in the background, and even then ageism was something that people were aware of and talked about, but it seems like we've remembered all sorts of different kinds of discrimination in America, but ageism is one that's just kind of dropped off of our radars.
John, thank you so much for that call. So, you know, in these conversations, and certainly what John was saying, that we are at least talking about sexism, racism, issues like that. Why do you think ageism is still, I guess, socially acceptable?
It's a wonderful question, and I really appreciate John's comment. I do think that that progressives have not taken ageism as seriously as they ought to. And I think we need a new hashtag that would go Me Too against ageism, mm-hmm. and start accumulating the stories around it. There are many reasons. The first one I would is that people are ashamed of getting older in this culture. The youth culture is so powerful and so expressive in so many ways. I mean, the absence of older people now in terms of the visual media, billboards and the age gaze itself, the gaze that says you are not attractive, you are invisible, you are not somebody I want to talk to, you are the person I'm not going to listen to at the meeting. I think all of this makes getting older in our culture a source of many indignities, many demotions, many humiliations, many traumas. And that trauma, I mean, just look at trauma studies. Has there been another field that has not looked at ageism's source, the sources of trauma that come from ageism? So we don't have the stories that we ought to have. Partly as a result, we don't have a movement. And I think that's really the answer to John's very good statement about where we are. We don't have a movement because even though AARP has millions of people who belong to it, it doesn't constitute a movement. You can get the Hollywood actresses to say, we're all discriminated against as we get older, but they don't constitute a movement. And one another thing that is lacking is the coalitions that form a movement. We, other coalitions do form, and they are overlapping interest groups. Well, you have so many intersections in terms of old age. It is not a united category in any way. It's full of people who were and are Republicans or Democrats. They're very poor. They're enormously wealthy. They have great educations. Some people die at 50. They never get to old age. Other people are dying in their 90s. So it's not, and of course it's not a category that has, no matter how you think of it, how wildly dispersed older people are, it's not a category that threatens the polity. It doesn't rush into the streets.
Hmm. Well, we're talking to Margaret Morgenroth-Gullett right now. She's a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. I want to go to our callers again. We have Eloise and Washara. Hi, Eloise.
Hello. Yeah, I was listening to your conversation, and I said, wait a minute. I'm discriminated against because I'm in my late 60s. I have a medical problem, and the doctor says, well, you have to expect these things at your age. And we don't do surgery when people are your age because the results aren't that good. So, you know, just because I'm 68 years old, I chop wood, I run a chainsaw, I ride around on my property and stuff.
Eloise, thank you so much for that call. So, I mean, Eloise is hitting kind of two points, which is the sort of everyday feeling of being discriminated against by her doctor, given her age, being told, hey, it doesn't make sense for us to pursue this medical care. So, you know, how frequent is that happening in doctor's offices?
Eloise has hit a difficult subject that has not been researched enough, and that is medical ageism. There have been a number of studies, and I quote some of them in my book, that do say that if you're over a certain age, you are less likely to get treated for women for breast cancer, for example. You're over a certain age, it's just a fact that you will not get the same treatment as people, say, under 55. I think there are doctors now who are saying, well, we will give an operation to a person in her 90s if her other health conditions are good and we think she can benefit from it. But I think there is still an enormous amount of medical ageism, and I think it comes partly from medical school. I mean, there is something that people learn in medical school. It's called GOMERS, and it means get out of my emergency room. Mm. So you learn it when you're a resident, and you may carry that with you through the rest of your medical practice. And it's because old people have a reputation. Sometimes this is true, sometimes it's not true, of coming in with many complex medical conditions. Now, if you're a geriatrician, which means you work mainly with older people in your practice, then you enjoy that. It's an intellectual challenge and an emotional challenge and an ethical challenge, and you're going to do very well with that range of people. But you start off as a resident saying, get him out of my emergency room, get him off to some specialist, I don't want them, I don't want to look at them, I don't want to see them, I don't want to touch them. And that may, in fact, endure through your surgical training and your medical training. Now, I would like to see There's a new oath that some of the medical schools are offering, and it says, I will not discriminate, and then they're the usual list. The usual list, I will not discriminate against people because of their race, their gender, their sexuality, et cetera. Age is not even on that progressive oath. It could be.
And do you think that we will be able to convince the medical field to consider adding ageism to that, hey, we're not going to participate in this in order to provide the best care that we can?
We could go profession by profession and say what's
sure.
needed. believe me, I would like everybody in the medical profession to read those chapters of my book and have an enlightened moment and decide that they're going to change their course practices, that I would like the United States government to add more geriatric training in the medical schools. I'd like the medical schools to offer geriatric training to every resident. I mean, you know, we in this field, the people who work in gerontology, of course, particularly, who are so interested in health in later life, they have lists of the things that could be done. There's no lack of information about what needs to be done.
So is it, in just about the minute and a half that we have left, do you think it's possible to end ageism, or, not to be too cynical, do you think it might be too ingrained in our culture?
I think I see certain signs that we are moving into a period that is going to be less accepting of ageism. But until we attack the Republicans in Congress for wanting to cut Medicaid, until we see that cutting Medicare is an ageist practice, until we see that cutting Social Security is an ageist practice, we have to start at the top with the neoliberalism that is constructing scarcity in order to cut the social safety nets from our old people. It has to, I think, start not just from the bottom, from our good hearts, but from the top, from their ill intentions.
Are you confident that it could happen? Could it be done?
Oh, certainly it could be done. We have an election in 2018. I mean, if we get enough people activated about Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, Medicare itself, the budget that just came out this week, I mean, it was no Valentine that was thrown to us this week by Trump's administration.
Well, thank you so much, Margaret. It was really great talking to you today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was Margaret Morgenroth-Goulette. She is a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University. She joined us to talk about ageism, ageist discrimination, and some steps we can take to end it.